Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in African American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I am your host, Adam McNeil. Today, I have Dr. Alejandro de la Fuente and Dr. Ariella Gross, co-authors of Becoming Free, Becoming Black, Race, Freedom, and Law in Cuba, Virginia, and Louisiana, published in 2020 by Cambridge University Press. Dr. de la Fuente is the Robert Woods Professor of Latin American History and Economics, Professor of African and African American Studies, and the founding director of the Afro-Latin American Research Institute at Harvard University. Dr. Gross is the John B. and Alice R. Sharp Professor of Law and History and the co-director of the Center for Law, History, and Culture at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. De La Fuente and Dr. Gross.
Thank you.
Good, good. And, you know, like I was telling y'all offline, it's a pleasure and an honor to have you on the podcast today. I've been reading the book and it's just incredible. And so I'm just so excited to get the discussion going. And so with that, I'll shoot it to you, Dr. Gross. We'll let you start off with this one. What are the origins of Becoming Free and Becoming Black?
So Alejandro and I have been talking about writing a comparative history of law, race, and slavery for at least 10 years, probably more. But I'd say we got going in earnest about 6 years ago. And I think we both came to this from the study of the law of slavery and race in particular locations in the Americas, but with comparative questions very much in mind. And I think we both recognized that we probably needed to work with someone who had the expertise on, you know, different archives and languages and just that local knowledge to do a real kind of from the bottom up comparative history. And so that's how, you know, we started thinking about working together. But the book changed a lot, I think, from our original conception, which had been really much more comprehensive, like let's, you know, kind of compare all of the law of slavery in these two places or three places, really. And but as we were working on it and realizing that our key question, how do you end up by 1860 with such different regimes of race in Cuba as in Virginia and Louisiana, that question really was not answered by looking at all of the law of slavery, but really looking at the law of freedom, how people who were enslaved became free, how they made claims on legal institutions to become free, and how their lives are regulated once they became free, and that it was there that societies are drawing the line between black and white.
Very good. And yeah, like that was something that I was really interested in learning about, because I'm always interested in how do projects come to be. And one of the things I love is also, you know, learning about, you know, co-authored pieces too, because that's obviously a very different process than if you're a single, if you're the author of a book by yourself, right? And so with that too, you know, on that actual point, right, you both are well-published historians. So I'm also very highly interested to know how co-authoring a book differs from writing a single author text, and specific to your experience with becoming free, becoming black.
So we get this question, all the time. And I think the first thing we always say is that it was actually easier than we expected initially. The unfortunate thing is that the way academia is structured and the way, you know, tenure clocks and tenure reviews and all these things are structured, this kind of project it's very difficult to do for junior scholars. Therefore, by the time we came to the project, both Ariel and I had, as you well said, we both had published widely, and we were both advanced enough in our careers that we could take a risk. We could do something that I at least had not really done before, although I had worked in my Havana book. I did work with a couple of collaborators who are acknowledged as collaborators in the front page of that book. But this was a very different project, because we basically, by the time we got together, we both had interest on comparative legal histories of slavery. We both were interested in going outside the cases we knew best. But we had not even done all the research yet. We had to do some primary research, not to mention the writing. So the way we did it was we first wrote a couple of papers. The first one was a paper that was something of a literature review on comparative legal histories of race and slavery in the Americas. We then published a couple of additional articles together. And I think those articles gave us an opportunity to, you know, learn about each other and develop routines that were later very useful for the book. Now, the book is a true collaboration. It's a true collaboration on the front of research. It's a true collaboration on writing as well. We would not divide. We never divided chapters according to areas. So one of us would take the lead in writing a first draft of a whole chapter, including the three cases that we study in the book: Virginia, Louisiana, and Havana, and Cuba. And then we would start a process by which the chapter, the draft, would go back and forth among us. Quite a few times. And that, at the end of the day, it's therefore very difficult to know who wrote exactly what. Ariela would send a first draft to me. I would not edit or correct. I would rewrite the chapter and send it back to her. She would rewrite my rewriting and send it back to me. And after several of those rewrites, it was very difficult to say or to, you know, to identify who had written what. So it was a true collaborative process, and I must say that it was actually I think it looks more painful from outside than it did for us. It was not a process without tensions, because sometimes in those rewrites, there were points that were contentious points. We did not always agree, even on some of the main arguments. And it took us a while, and it took us several rewrites to reach a point in which we developed, through conversation, through exchange, through critical readings, we would develop eventually a common understanding and a common argument about some of the processes that we were trying to describe.
And I would just add to that, I think, co-authoring, and one of the reasons it's something people tend to do later, not at the beginning of a career, it actually takes longer because of that, because there is the revision and rethinking along the way. But I do feel as though it made our arguments stronger, made the research stronger even, because there were points where challenging one another led us to think, we need to know more about that. We need to look at more cases. We need to find out more on this particular question. And so I feel like that was actually a really healthy process, the disagreements at least as much as the agreements. But, I also think it helps that neither of us is really one of those people who's very wed to their particular words. And we were on a panel with another co-authoring team where they said, it became very contentious at the very end, more contentious over time and very contentious at the very end as that when these are the final words. And I felt like it was the complete opposite, that by the end we were really, all the disagreements had been resolved. And that for the most part, when it came to particular words, we're both happy to be edited and are very attached to our own, particular phrasing.
The process of, turning the disagreements into an opportunity, I think made a big difference, as Ariella suggests, because when you write something on your own, you read it and you may give it to a few colleagues, friends to take a look at, to give you opinions. But here we're talking about something different. We were rewriting each other, and therefore we were basically telling each other, no, you didn't get this right. No, I don't agree with this. And as Ariella mentioned, that forced us to, it forced us to refine the arguments so that we could defend our own positions with each other. And in the process, I would describe that as intellectually fun. I mean, I had a good time. I mean, if you had asked me in the middle of it, maybe I would have told you something different. But the way I recall this was as a true exhilarating intellectual experience, because I had someone who was reading this very carefully, and when she didn't agree with something, she would articulate an alternative argument, an alternative vision. And in order to contest that, or in order to supersede that, or in order to engage with that, you had to basically bring yourself to the level required to articulate an alternative argument. So it was actually a great process intellectually.
And that's great to learn as someone, knee deep in graduate study. It helps me to look through the weeds and see there is hope for collaboration at some point. And so hearing your jubilation really is really awesome. And it's really good to know. And with that, specific to the book, I did have a very, very important question to ask y'all. You focus on Cuba, Virginia, and Louisiana, and you focus on them as prime locations to study race, freedom, and the law. But let me ask y'all, why did y'all end up choosing Cuba, Virginia, and Louisiana specifically, and especially because of, you know, Cuba has Havana and Virginia is mostly, you know, a lot of the whole state or colony, depending on the time frame, and Louisiana with New Orleans. So I was very interested to learn, you know, why did you choose those three specific areas?
I think there are a few reasons why these three places made sense. We started with thinking about Cuba and Virginia, which had been a kind of classic comparison of, you know, two plantation societies from a Spanish and a British tradition. It was, you know, Herbert Klein had done that comparison, and there's been in general in the United States, as you know, a lot of focus on Virginia as sort of a birthplace of plantation slavery. And we really wanted to add Louisiana, both for the, you know, French legal tradition of its earliest settlers, but also because it's such an interesting hybrid legally, and culturally, right, changes hands from French to Spanish to American or U.S. And also it's kind of a crossroads. So New Orleans is a place where people from Havana are coming to and leaving from, and they're going from Saint-Domingue to New Orleans, sometimes through Havana. And so there is also a lot of really interesting kind of exchange. And although we really wanted to keep the comparative framework for thinking about these legal regimes, it's also, I think, a transnational story. It's not looking at each of these places as hermetically sealed, you know, comparators, but rather as three locations in this wider world that has a lot of connections.
And I thought it was very interesting too, because I love comparative stuff, and so I was just really interested to know why, because what I enjoyed the most about the comparison that y'all bring up between Cuba, Virginia, and Louisiana is not only the way that things change hands as far as, like, you know, especially somewhere like Louisiana, but how throughout it all I didn't get lost. Because that's the other thing I always worry about sometimes about reading comparative work is, will there ever come a time when I get lost in the comparison, I guess, is the best way to say. But thankfully, to all y'all listening and who are going to buy this book from Cambridge University Press, you will not get lost. It will be never a time that you will. But with that, one of the other important terms that y'all use throughout the book is the term manumission. And I think that, you know, as scholars and such who write about slavery regimes, understanding what manumission means in specific context and in broad context, I think is important for those who are going to read the book too. So can y'all define can you define what manumission is and why it's an important aspect of your comparative study?
So manumission is really the right that a slave owner has to give freedom to an enslaved person. So manumission is frequently presented as a slave right, but in fact, we are talking, if we're talking about the law and about how this social process was understood, it was always really a slave, a right of the slave owners. Now, manumission is absolutely central to our argument, because this right, the right of the slave owners to concede freedom to an enslaved person, this right is curtailed, is limited fairly early. By that I mean early 18th century, in some cases late 17th century, but certainly early 18th century, is limited in in Virginia and in Louisiana, where manumission requires usually some form of official approval, and it's never limited in Cuba. So one of the questions that we need to grapple with, that we need to deal with, is why manumission is never legally curtailed in Cuba. Now, that's only one side of the story. In fact, our emphasis is placed not on slave owners, the right of slave owners to give, quote-unquote, freedom, but rather our emphasis is placed on how enslaved people try to build on that legal possibility and to make claims to their freedom. What kind of strategies, initiatives did enslaved people undertake in order to escape slavery? And here, the stories of these three jurisdictions are very different. But the main distinction by far is the distinction between Havana and Virginia and Louisiana. On Havana on the one hand and Virginia and Louisiana on the other hand. Now, so by the time of the Age of Revolution, by the 1760s and 1770s, Havana has a much larger population of free people of color than either Louisiana or Virginia. And the explanation that we advance in the book has nothing to do with, some special Iberian cultural predisposition to freedom or a more humane attitude towards slaves or any of that. It is the fact that manumission in the Iberian world was not tied to race-making efforts. Manumission was a traditional legal possibility in Iberia that was applied to enslaved people of various origins and backgrounds. People, Muslims, Christians, people from the Eastern Mediterranean. Whereas manumission in Virginia and Louisiana get linked from almost from the very beginning, although not quite in the case of Virginia, to race-making efforts. In other words, if you want to really create a perfect world of enslaved Africans and free Europeans or free whites or people of European descent, then the very possibility of Black freedom complicates, negates, creates, distorts that perfect world. If you want to create a racial order in which Blacks means enslavement and white means freedom, then free Blacks, free people of color, are a problematic intermediate group that is best avoided. That's what Virginia and Louisiana do with, fairly brutal success in the 18th century. In Cuba, on the other hand, by the 1770s, about 15 or 16% of the total population of the colony is composed by free people of color. And that, in our view, makes an enormous difference in how legal regimes concerning slaves then evolve into the 19th century.
And that is something that I thought was very interesting, and I highlighted it in my own reading, kind of like the pushback, right, that you're speaking about in terms of, I wouldn't say it's a consensus, but the popular imagination that things are just, quote unquote, easier maybe through the Iberian context. So that was a part that I was very I'm very happy, rather, that you highlighted. And so a question I had, and as well, the 18th century plays a major part in your story, right? It almost seems like the nexus point, specifically about the way that racial distinctions became stronger and firmer through legal regulation. And so can you tell us why the 18th century was so important for building the connection between race and enslavability?
Yeah, I would pick up on what Alejandro was talking about in terms of the age of revolution. I think, you know, the middle chapter of our book, which focuses on this period that we date as, you know, starting in the 1760s. And there's a very particular moment in Louisiana because Louisiana changes hands from the French to the Spanish in 1763. And goes really, we argue, all the way through the 1820s, and we take that chapter up to 1830, because it's that time in the late 18th century and early 19th century when, you know, ironically, of course, the United States has a revolution, becomes a republic, but and northern states begin gradual emancipation of enslaved people. But, you know, historians have talked about a contagion of liberty, right? This idea that all around the Americas, people, enslaved people are making claims for freedom. They're rebelling for freedom in Haiti, which strikes terror in the hearts of all of these slave owners around the Americas as well. It inspires rebels in other locations in the Americas. It inspires rebellions. It inspires anti-slavery activists. And so you have this moment both manumission, self-purchase, freedom suits increase exponentially in all three of the places that we're talking about. It's most dramatic probably in Louisiana, where as soon as the Spanish arrive, enslaved people get the news about Spanish forms of legal self-purchase, a coartación, and start, you know, bringing cases and winning them. And, but it's also remarkable in Virginia, which passes laws that not only make it easier for an enslaved person to become free, but even to have a free lawyer to bring a freedom suit. And so you could imagine that story being, oh, wow, the importance of the Age of Revolution really is just this rising tide of freedom and emancipation. But of course, we know that isn't the case, that in fact, it's the era of the entrenchment of plantation slavery. It's the rise of the cotton gin, and the cotton economy is the late 18th, early 19th century. So that's happening at the same time as the expansion of the population of free people of color. And although in many ways, this is a moment where Virginia and Louisiana look most like Cuba, we argue it's where the roots, where the seeds are planted for this enormous crackdown on free people of color and on manumission that comes after 1830. It because of the political connection that's drawn between manumission and race making, which, as Alejandro says, never happens in Cuba. But if you look, for example, at the petitions that ordinary Virginians are bringing to, white Virginians are bringing to the General Assembly in Virginia in the early 19th century regarding free people of color, they're saying, oh, you know, you all of this emancipation needs to stop. And they're calling individual manumission partial emancipation, and they're connecting it to what they call general emancipation. So they're drawing this connection where they're politicizing individual emancipation and suggesting this is going to lead to the the end of slavery. It's going to threaten all of the institution of slavery. Where in a more, in the Spanish Empire, that isn't in individual manumission is not seen as bringing down the whole system. And in part, that's because of the Republican ideals that are being used in a place like Virginia in this, white supremacist way, connecting white freedom and Republican values to Black enslavement and degraded status. So it's kind of, I think, ironic from the U.S. perspective that Republican politics is playing such a part in it. Small R Republican.
One way to also think about this, to follow up very briefly on Ariela's point, is that although during the Age of Revolution, manumission rates actually grow or appear to grow across these jurisdictions, the meanings of Black freedom are very different. As she said, in a place like Virginia, Black freedom is immediately perceived as a threat. It's perceived as a threat to the established order and to Republican politics, because Black freedom in a place like Virginia, and increasingly in Louisiana in the 19th century, is tied to Black citizenship. Whereas in Havana, in Cuba, Black freedom is not tied to Black citizenship. Black freedom leads to free Blacks are not seen as equal citizens with equal political rights. They enter a society of where racial and other social hierarchies are pronounced, and where manumission is not tied to revolutionary ideas of equality and fraternity. Manumission in Havana is a legal practice of the ancien regime. It's a traditional legal practice that has nothing to do with Black citizenship and Black equality.
And actually, like, that's so very important, because, when you're talking about the Age of Revolution and you're talking about also what happens after it, you're starting to see larger communities of free Black people as well. And, that actually leads into my next question. And Dr. De La Fuente, you can take this one on first. You highlight how, the most significant difference among, these jurisdictions concern the size and importance of their communities of free people of color. And that was a quote from page 72. Why were the surrounding communities of free people of color so significant to the divergent legal regimes of manumission and freedom and law in Cuba, Virginia, and Louisiana?
Well, the dangers that we were talking about before, about Black citizenship, that danger felt to many white people in Virginia and also by the 1810s and 1820s in Louisiana. That danger felt increasingly real and large and concrete as those communities grew, which they did grow. And it was a significant growth, although it was from rather modest beginnings. But these communities did grow significantly between the 1770s and the 1820s. So that danger felt very real and very concrete to many white residents, who began, in fact, to advocate not only for legal measures that would preclude manumission, that would preclude this partial emancipations, as Ariela mentioned, but that would, in fact, even remove free Blacks from their midst. That would simply make it impossible for free people of color to live and to build communities and families and lives in their places of birth. And that's the origin of all these colonization processes and initiatives that we discuss in the book. But the size of the community of free people of color matters also in rather concrete and consequential ways, which is that this community provided resources, support, legal knowledge, access for enslaved people to escape slavery. Therefore, the size of that community goes a long way explaining how and the frequency with which enslaved people could escape from slavery, could use different legal resources and legal opportunities, fabricate legal opportunities in order to escape from slavery, either by purchasing their own freedom, finding the resources to pay their manumission price, or by perhaps claiming, as they did in Virginia and Louisiana, that they had ancestors, female ancestors, who were not enslaved Africans, but who were either Indians or free people, and therefore that they should be free. So the existence of this community is quite important. And here, and this goes back to your previous question about the 18th century, here there is already a massive difference between Havana on that front, on this particular but rather important point. There's a massive difference between Havana and, Louisiana and Virginia by the 1770s. Havana already has a much larger community of free people of color. Now, slave owners and colonial authorities in early 19th century Cuba were not particularly happy about this community. They, in fact, did their very best to delimit the social standing and the opportunities of this community as much as possible. But there are, in several remarkable private documents, you see the acknowledgement that there was little they could do about it because that community was just so large that it was simply impossible to destroy the community and to take the rights to which they felt entitled. That it would have put in danger the whole colonial order to do so. So you are quite right in highlighting this, because it's actually one of our key arguments in the book.
And I know we're getting closer to our end time, so I wanted to transition from there to look at more of looking forward questions and kind of more introspective. So Dr. Gross, I'll shoot this one out to you first. I guess this is one of my favorite questions, right? What did you learn about yourselves because of this process of creating, of writing the book collaboratively, becoming free and becoming Black? What did you all learn about yourselves because of this process?
That's a great question. I think it made me, it certainly made me question some of my prior. So, the book that I wrote before this by myself was a book called What Blood Won't Tell, A History of Race on Trial in America. And What Blood Won't Tell looked at trials of racial identity where courts are trying to figure out whether someone is Black or white or Indian. And it argued that over the course of the 19th and 20th centuries, that these contestations over race in court really helped constitute both Blackness and whiteness in America, but particularly the linkage between whiteness and citizenship in U.S. law. And but a big piece of it for me was about discovering all of these middle grounds between Black and white, and groups like the Melungeons and, these entire communities of racially ambiguous people in the United States who lived with kind of contested racial identities for a long time. And one of the reasons I was so interested in the comparison with Cuba was because traditionally the comparison between Latin America and the United States had always been contrasting the fluidity and multiple racial identities of Latin America with the kind of black and white one drop rule of the United States. But since I had been arguing, no, actually the United States wasn't just black and white, how would that look to me when I started to look comparatively? And I think it strengthened some of what I had thought about U.S. history before, but it also challenged some of it. That is, comparatively, as much as I want to emphasize, right, the claims to citizenship that people of color were making in the United States and the extent that people did live between black and white, and the challenges to that black and white world, by contrast to the possibilities or opportunities that were open to people of color in Cuba, I had to acknowledge that they were less in the United States. What I had argued before, that the real operation of race in the law was this linkage between whiteness and citizenship, I ended up feeling even more strongly that is what really defined the United States, both Virginia and by 1860 Louisiana, although I think it took a lot longer there. But what defined the racial regime in contrast to Cuba was this linkage between citizenship and whiteness. And that is, you know, it's a tragic and, you know, today I would say even enraging story, because it's not just a sad story about race in the United States. And one I keep thinking is still so present with us today. So I think that's sort of what I learned from this. Alejandro may have.
Well, you know, I certainly share what you've said, Ariel. I would only add that one thing that, you know, we both came to this project with a fairly well-informed suspicion, but a suspicion nonetheless, that you know, that national historiographies only take you that far in the understanding of the creation of racial regimes across the Atlantic. We had the urge to go outside our comfort zones and to seriously explore other cases. You know, writing this book confirmed that, at least to me, beyond any doubt, that it is important for scholars of slavery, race, the law, to contest, ignore, transcend national boundaries, to learn from other places, and to become familiar with other historiographies. I think that's one area that is increasingly certainly reflected in my own teaching and in how I think about these things. Although at the same time, doing actual research in several locations at once, and doing the kind of comparative work we did in the book over time, you know, for several centuries, is a daunting task for an individual.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I definitely think that, you know, I'm always interested to learn, like, how people. how people are changed by the projects that they do. And also, this would be the last one. This would be the one that we'll go out on. As scholars, right, your work means a lot to many people, especially as we try to understand and break down the history of race, especially in our world. And so as scholars that do this work, what motivates you to continue doing this work?
The Ariella was talking about historians always write about the present in some ways, right? Ariella was talking about our very particular present. I always say that we should not forget that we began working on this project, before the White House was transformed into the White House. It was a different moment, but still in that moment under President Barack Obama, the salience of race, the social effects of racism and racist policies, the enduring legacies of enslavement, racial discrimination, these are things that we, both Ariel and I, had experienced differently. I grew up in Cuba, but we both had experienced this. And I think that, at least on my end, but she and I have talked about this many times, this is a major motivation to try to understand how our current understandings of blackness and whiteness were historically produced. These things are not natural. We frequently say that race is a social construct, but frankly, that has become almost a cliche that has no substance, no meaning, unless you actually look at the process of how that construction took place. And that, in a sense, is what we try to do in the book.
Yeah. I said that earlier that, the moment is not only tragic, but enraging. I just today keep thinking about George Floyd and, the people who die every day from racism in this country. And I think that's, that effort to understand that history, to bring it front and center, to try to break that equation of whiteness and citizenship, to make real all of the ways that that history continues to play out. I think that's, our job today. So we have to keep doing it even on days that, you think, oh my gosh, how do people keep going?
And that's correct, right? That's the thing. The work that we all do, as Dr. De La Fuente said, it has a lot to do with our present, despite, a lot of our work being centuries well before now. But it's always good to learn from scholars who are at your levels what it is that keeps you going and what helps to motivate you, as you, Dr. Gross, brought up, in the times of torment that it seems that we're in that are not cyclical. They just are ones that sometimes have a higher visibility level, which, considering our date, May 27th of 2020, when we're recording this, seems to be one of those days and times. But hopefully to the listening audience who just listened to this interview, who are listening to this interview, hopefully this is a phenomenal conversation that you can learn from and build from through the phenomenal information that's contained within Dr. Alejandro De La Fuente and Dr. Ariella Gross's co-authored book, Becoming Free, Becoming Black, Race, Freedom, and Law in Cuba, Virginia, and Louisiana, published in 2020 by Cambridge University Press. And I want to thank both of you, Dr. De La Fuente and Dr. Gross, for coming on to the podcast today, because our conversation has been incredible.
Thank you, Adam.
Thanks, Adam. Really enjoyed it.
Very good. And so, folks, once again, my name is Adam McNeil, co-host of New Books in African American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. Please rate us and review us. Please show us and tell us how we are doing. And please also buy this phenomenal book and also buy more books from Cambridge University Press. And Dr. De La Fuente is also an amazing co-editor of the Afro-Latin American History Series at Cambridge University Press. And we have some phenomenal books coming out from there. Hi, Dr. Barragan. I know you're listening. And so I know that you guys are going to support, as you always, always do. And thank you so much for your support. And once again, please rate us or review us wherever you get your podcasts. And so it's over and out time, y'all. Thank you so much from New Books in African American Studies. Adam McNeil, over and out.